Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
It's very, very good to see all of you today, and very, very good to be here and have the opportunity to sit with you. I want to share with you the third case of the Blue Cliff Record, at least portions of it, not the full commentary, but Master Ma is unwell. Matsu, great Master Matsu, very imposing figure in the Zen tradition. Tall guy, 7 feet tall or something, I forget, but a big, big man, not like Suzuki Roshi, and a tongue that could cover his forehead, or something like that. And that was maybe metaphorical for his eloquence, I don't know. But anyway, he's a seminal figure in early Chan, early Zen. The pointer says, one device, the pointer is like the introduction to the case. One device, one object, one word, one phrase. The intent is that you'll have a place to enter. Still, this is gouging wound in healthy flesh. It can become a nest or a den. So devices to kind of like get you vibing with the way are already making a mess of things. And you're liable to camp out there thinking you found something. The great function appears without abiding by fixed principles. The intent is that you realize that there is something transcendental. It covers the sky and covers the earth, yet it cannot be grasped. This way will do, not this way will do. This is too diffuse. This way won't do, not this way won't do either. This is too cut off. Without trading these two paths, what would be right? Please test. I cite this case for you to see. It's a very short case. Great Master Ma was unwell. Some commentary said he was near death. The temple superintendent asked him, "Teacher, how has your venerable health been in recent days?" The great master said, "Sun-faced Buddha. Moon-faced Buddha." So a couple of tidbits from the commentary. That's the whole case. You know, the superintendent inquires about Master Ma's health. He says, sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. Now, sun-faced Buddha lives for a long, long time, many, many eons, apparently. You know, long time. The moon-faced Buddha lives for one day, one night. Very short lifespan, the moon-faced Buddha. So Master Ma is choosing to answer the question by referring to these two images in the pantheon of the history of the tradition. So some tidbits from the commentary. These days, many people say that Master Ma was teaching the superintendent, that he had the intent to teach something in saying this. Fortunately, this has no connection. He wasn't trying to be wise. He wasn't trying to teach anything, is what the commentator seems to be suggesting. Right now, there are many in this assembly who misunderstand. They put a glare in their eyes and say, it's here, the left eye is the sun-faced Buddha, the right eye is the moon-faced Buddha. What relevance does this have? In other words, they posture. They indulge in some Zen macho bullshit and say that that's the intent of this question. Where Suzuki Roshi says, this doesn't mean, I don't care, sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. It's not indifference. It's not some sort of aloofness. And so that has nothing to do with it. Some say he meant, fix some stomach medicine and bring me a bowl of it. And some people say, well, he was complaining and he wanted some respite from his pain. What grasp has this got on it? So there's some tidbits from the commentary. So it's not a teaching of Zen power, of I don't care, sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. And it's not, I'm sick and I want some comfort. What is it? So here's the verse. Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha, what kind of people were the ancient emperors? For 20 years, I have suffered bitterly. How many times have I gone down into the Blue Dragon's cave for you? Now, dragons in Zen iconography have a jewel either in their claw or in their jaw. And that jewel is the Mani jewel, or that jewel is Bodhicitta, or that jewel is the ultimate concern of our practice. It's not really describable, graspable, as it says earlier in the text, but that's what it is. It's the ultimate point. You can call it what you will, but nothing quite gets to it. Now the problem, so the jewel is what we want. The jewel is what our intention is in practicing. Now the problem is that it's got this dragon to deal with. So that's the implication of the iconography. You know, if you want to actually aspire to practice the way and appreciate the jewel of the way, well, you've got to deal with the dragon. So, how many times have I gone down into the Blue Dragon's cave for you? This distress is worth recounting. Clear-eyed, patrobed monks should not take it lightly. Clear-eyed, patrobed monks, practitioners, students of the way, should not take it lightly. So the whole poem again. Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha, what kind of people were the ancient emperors? For 20 years I have suffered bitterly. How many times have I gone down into the Blue Dragon's cave for you? This distress, some translations say bitterness, this distress is worth recounting. Clear-eyed practitioners should not take it lightly. And then there's some verses commenting on the verses themselves. And one is, this distress, he saddens people to death. Sad man, don't speak to sad people, is worth recounting. To whom would you speak of it? You speak of it to sad people. If you speak of it to sad people, you will sadden them to death. So, well, I find those verses amusing. So there is distress, there is sadness. That seems pretty clear, both from the commentary and from the verse, and the distress that's worth recounting. And then the commentary to the verse, where he reiterates the word sadness quite a bit. So, there's a thing I want to share with you from Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, that I think has a bearing on this case. Oops. This is Suzuki Roshi. Apparently he said that close to when he actually did get sick. He says, if when I die, the moment I'm dying, if I suffer, that is all right, you know. That is suffering Buddha. Moon-faced Buddha. No confusion in it. No confusion in it. Maybe everyone will struggle because of the physical agony or spiritual agony. Two. But that is all right. That is not a problem. We should be very grateful to have a limited body like mine or like yours. If you had a limitless life, it would be a real problem for you. So if he suffers, it's all right. If it's physical or even spiritual agony, it's all right, he says. Maybe there'll be a lot of grief, you know, but that's okay too. And then that word, no confusion in it. I think that's a pivotal thing, no confusion. So, how to stay present with the fullness of our life? What does it mean to be present to the distress, to the suffering that's inevitable? No confusion in it. I was thinking about something I read early on. I think my first summer in Tassajara, I spent a lot of time in the Tassajara library. I would stay up till midnight. And yeah, he's on the Eno at the time. He says, well, as long as you make it to morning meditation, it's okay. Do what you want. And I read this transcript of a conference or a seminar that Trungpa Rinpoche gave at one time. And in that seminar, somebody asked a question about leg pain.
Leg pain.
You know, when you sit a lot, the knees start to hurt, or other things can hurt too, but, you know, it's inevitable. It seems almost inevitable that when you're sitting a lot during Sashin, the knees will start to burn. So they'll really start to hurt. And so that becomes a very interesting thing to work with. And his only response, I forget exactly what the question was, like, you know, I was sort of complaining about the pain, you know, how can I sit when the knees are so hurting? What can I do about that? You know, so it was okay to like change my posture. And his only response was, that's just your resistance. That's just your resistance. And when I read that, as a new student having my own difficulty sitting a simple 40-minute period, I was that's kind of harsh. That's not very compassionate. Yeah. But for some reason, that also intrigued me, and it stayed with me. And I have been practicing with that for more or less my whole time. And it's really interesting. When the knees start to hurt, and I feel, I don't like this. If I turn and start to investigate what's going on, I start to be attentive. What's the sensation actually feel like? What is it like, independent of my dislike of it? Which tendons or which ligaments or which muscle fibers are actually screaming? Can I identify exactly where it is? I discover unconscious contraction. And you know, the moment I discover unconscious contraction, it releases. And I can, you know, sometimes I'll feel, you know, something in the knee just kind of like release, like I was like, you know how you go to the dentist and when they approach, your body tightens up, you know, without your willing it? It's kind of like that. There's musculature in my knees that had it tightened up. And that wasn't helping at all. But with clear attention, with clear comprehension, without my trying to, just being very present and attentive, to the actual discomfort, to the actual sensation, there would be a release. Sometimes there's this muscle in my thigh. And some this morning, you know, I'd be attentive, and although every once in a while, it would just kind of release. And it's not something that you can will. You know, if you try to make it, you can't send neurological energy down there to relax the muscle. Neurological energy contracts the muscle. The problem is that there's already too much neurological energy, unnecessary neurological energy going down there. So you can't make it happen, but with careful attentiveness to the discomfort, gentle, compassionate presence with it, sometimes a release might occur. So this notion of resistance, I think, plays in here. You know. And this notion of resistance is the thing that causes the confusion. When seeing clearly, with clear comprehension, there's no confusion, there's no suffering. And I can sometimes get to a point where, yeah, there's a lot of activity happening in here, a lot of, you know, sensation happening here, but it's kind of interesting. It's kind of like crashing waves on a rocky shore or fireworks on the 4th of July. Wow, that's what a show, you know. And there's equanimity. The word pain doesn't seem to apply anymore. But what does it say in the pointer about it, you know, if you don't let that become a cave, don't let that be something you try to pursue, because then you're heading in the wrong direction. But it's interesting to me, this notion of resistance and working with resistance, being vigilant for resistance as an opportunity. And I had I had resistance to the notion of resistance early on in my Zen career. You know, people would describe the forms of practice, like Orioki. You're supposed to do it a certain way. You know, you pick up, you unfold your claws a certain way, and do this, that. And it's really great, they say, because you can notice your resistance to not wanting to do it that way. And I would think, it's such a beautiful practice. It's how we express our heart. Why do you call it? Why do you want to look at it that way? As a way to watch resistance, I felt resistance to the notion of, you know, looking at your resistance. You know, practice is more beautiful than that. I was maybe attached to the sun face Buddha a little bit. You know, I was attached to the springtime flowers and the butterflies and the cold chill of winter mornings wasn't to my taste. But I have become very, very intrigued by how careful, clear, compassionate attention to the moment of the arising of resistance can be very, very helpful. So Suzuki Roshi talks about, for a Zen student, a weed is a treasure. And he says that in gardening, when we weed the gardens, we take the weeds and we bury them close to the plant to give the plant nourishment. And he says that the weeds in your practice will actually nourish your practice. When you discover how the weeds become mental nourishment, your practice will make extraordinary progress. You will feel the progress. And this notion of resistance is very applicable here. I was, during the second period, there was a moment where I got kind of bored. And I said, okay, I've had enough. When is the period going to end? And I noticed that. And in the very noticing, in the very non-judgmental, clear, unconfused noticing of resistance, it's not like I noticed and then I decided to turn back. In the noticing, immediately, back. In the noticing of it as simply, oh, resistance. Not buying into, not elaborating upon how stupid it is to spend my Saturday mornings doing this. But so, I'm resisting just being present. And that very noticing, and I'm back in my seat. And then the birds sang. My reward for noticing. And then a sweet little song of birds. And I just happened to be present for it. Not, you know, so with Leiping, it's this notion of noticing the resistance, and with clear investigation of what's going on, how that readily helps us stay even more present, even more grounded, even more open, is pretty accessible. And practicing in this way, one feels really well pinned to one's seat. And a certain sense of, you know, gratefulness comes up, because practicing in this way with difficulties in the knees, one and persevering of setting resistance down, seeing it clearly, setting it down, immediately feeling much more grounded, much more present, is a fairly accessible experience. But practicing with emotional difficulty is more difficult. I want to try to say something about that, because I think it is vitally important. Because we have a lot of our strategies to resist just feeling emotional pain directly are more subtle, are more robust, and we fool ourselves so much more readily. Because of fear. The fear that the emotional pain brings up is so raw. So the temptation to find a cage or a nest to avoid the direct experience of emotional pain is very strong. And that cave or that nest can take many forms. Earlier this morning, when I was thinking of this talk, I thought of this phrase, resistance is futile. Any Star Trek fans in the room? That's the Borg saying, you know, we will add your biological uniqueness to our own, you know, prepare to be assimilated. Resistance is futile. Actually, resistance is worse than futile. Resistance is toxic. Resistance to actually being the moon-faced Buddha results in addiction, aggression, self-denigration, various things. Tara Brach talks about trance states. We'd rather choose a trance state than actually be with the difficulty. to compassionately clear comprehension that is precise and gentle and compassionate at the same time. We see what it is. We see it. If it's shame, we feel the shame. If it's regret, we feel the regret. If it's resentment, we feel the resentment. If it's judgment, we feel the judgment. That's, we see it clearly. We say, oh, right now what's arising in my heart is shame. Or how I treated Fred yesterday, or how I treated Billy when I was 7, whatever. You know, something comes up, we feel shame. Something comes up, we feel resentment. And the clear seeing is, oh, this is resentment. This is anger. You know, this is arrogance, whatever it might be. And then the compassion and gentleness to not judge that, to not hurt oneself over that. It's a very, very narrow edge of practice. It's like, you know, seeing the sensation just a sensation and then allowing the release of the contraction to happen is less problematic than seeing shame just as shame. Not judging oneself for it, having compassion there, letting the release happen, is much more difficult. Much, much more difficult. The temptation for the cave, the temptation for the nest, is much, much stronger. I'll just watch more silly sitcoms. I'll have an additional glass of wine. I'll believe my judgments about so-and-so, that my view of her is accurate and true, therefore I'm entitled to feel what I'm feeling. Or what seems harder to bear, but for some reason is more attractive, is I feel this shame because I am a despicable being. It's only natural that I feel this. And then the mind just spins frenetically, and somehow the frenetic, restless spinning of anxiety is preferred to just be present and still with the pain. Very, very difficult. Sun face Buddha, moon face Buddha. This distress is worth examining. Because without, when we can approach it, we approach the energy in the knees is just energy. Spaciousness arises. And this narrow, tight fight with the pain transforms into, wow, crashing waves on a rocky shore. Fireworks on the 4th of July. This is interesting. In this space. Same is true for emotional pain. If we can see it just as this energy of sorrow, just as this energy of irritation, and let go of the resistance to being with it, or let go of the narrative of self-blame for being worthy of it, we feel the energy just as energy, then there's some space, and we're not so protracted around it. We can breathe in the midst of it. Clear comprehension, understanding what's going on, is necessary. Which is something different from the stories that we have internalized about it. The stories that we tell about it are often internalized self-blame. Case in point is childhood trauma. The victim of abuse internalizes the abuse, so I must deserve it. The abuser's intent, I have read in my studies, is to instill in their victim fear and self-loathing. That's what trips their trigger, is to succeed in instilling fear and self-loathing in the victim. whether it's sexual abuse or bullying as a child, which is my particular trauma. And they're usually very successful. And so in that context, there's a core wound that occurs, and there's a self-concept that is formed in relationship to that trauma. And that can get us stuck, very, very stuck. And there can be a strong impulse to flee to a trance state to avoid the pain of that. It's when the pain is felt, the self-loathing self-image arises with it. But if we don't feel the pain, we cannot heal the wound. So how to actually surmount the resistance to feeling the wound in such a way that that healing can occur. A new element, a new energy needs to be present in the dynamic. Just reliving the trauma and reliving the narratives about the trauma is just going to re-traumatize. And that's what happens. Events happen later in life that touch that core wound, that bring forth more reliving of the trauma. So what is the process to actually be able to be a suffering Buddha when we have to be a suffering Buddha? What is a suffering Buddha? How does a suffering Buddha practice with suffering, with trauma, with pain? It's a very important question for me now. I did some studying of a talk by Tara Brach, and she talks about three things that are necessary. First is self-forgiveness or acceptance. That, you know, what happened, happened. You're not to blame for what happened. You've done various things since then to cope with the injustice, the pain, the cruelty. That was the best intelligence of the organism at the time to deal with it. You know, if it was alcoholism, if it was other things, if it was being prone to rage, whatever those things were, they were the best intelligence of the organism to survive the trauma. Don't understand that. Clearly comprehend that. Accept yourself, forgive yourself. That's step number one. Step number two is find a way to place yourself in a context of safety and peace. Love. So whatever that might mean for you, it could be for some, it might, Tara Brach mentions, it might be the thought of a loving God. Or it might be a good friend. Just bringing that friend to mind. It might be a certain place where you feel safe in nature. Or, like, for me, this is that kind of a place. Coming here one Saturday a month, I feel very safe. And I feel love. And so that sense of safety and peace gives one finding that way. So first you forgive yourself that you're worthy of doing this so that you can feel worthy of doing this. And probably forgive others too, but mainly start by forgiving yourself if there's some shame that's blocking you. Then, once you've done that, then you'll feel worthy enough to make the effort to find this container of safety where you feel safe and you feel love so that you can practice presence. Presence with what is distressful. Presence with what is painful, provocative of the grief and the shame that is still there that has to be healed. And then you can bring that sense of safety, that sense of forgiveness, that sense of love to the experiencing of the distress and surmount the resistance to being there and surmount the temptation to play out the old tape, the old interpretation of how this is what you deserve. And it's not easy work. It involves encountering the resistance to do it. You know, we would much rather watch more inane TV or have that second glass of wine or go dancing. Or, you know, the resistance comes up. But to heal, we need to be a suffering Buddha. We need to practice the moon-faced Buddha when these things arise. To not contract or flee into a trance state to find a nest or a cave to dwell in. We need to develop the resiliency to do this practice so that there's enough space for healing to occur. So the weeds can turn into nourishment. It takes commitment and the desire to do the practice for that to happen. It takes courage to step out into the light and not seek a dark corner to hide in. Dark corner is kind of cozy, but you don't get to see much when you're there. But just the willingness to attend to resistance is big. You know, it's very simple in the case of knee pain to study this. You know, when noticing the resistance, without even trying to, there's presence. Just noticing resistance as resistance is liberating. When you walk into a dark room and you turn on the light, where does the darkness go? So clear comprehension. Actually seeing what is there. You know, when it's difficult is when it is most to the clear comprehension, actually seeing what's there with compassion and understanding. It's difficult. But nothing can nurture our hearts more powerfully than that. Your practice will make extraordinary progress. You will feel progress. So, you know, it's a hard sell. Practice is a hard sell. Actual practice is a hard sell because some days it's moon-faced Buddha. Many days in our world, it's moon-faced Buddha. But actual practice is the only way to actually walk upright through this world with some sense of freedom. So I'm trying to convince myself at the same time that I'm preaching to you. But that's my message for today. Well, we've got 7 minutes.
What time is it?
It's 11:24.
Oh.
Glad to see you, Martha.
Thank you for the talk.
Thank you. Yes, too.
I'm thinking about a young niece that I have who's been saying this, and she retreats a lot, mm-hmm. and it's difficult to know if she's finding a place of peace or if she is going into a trance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And she enters in one mood.
Mm-hmm.
She enters her in one mood, and then maybe a day or two later, I mean, she comes out, but within her stopping this reclusiveness,
uh-huh.
she comes out and she's in a different,
yeah.
a more cheerful mood.
Yeah.
She goes in when she's down,
yeah.
and she stays in there until she can deal with that mm-hmm. downness, however she mm-hmm. does.
Yeah.
But she's still talking. She's not really there. She's not really present
yeah.
with you. And then after a couple of days or whatever it takes, it could
yeah.
be longer,
mm-hmm.
she comes out and then mm-hmm. she's the person that we know
yeah.
as a family member. She's a more cheerful, more productive person.
Yeah.
And it's causes concern.
Yeah.
Because nobody knows, nobody wants to deprive her of that.
Yeah.
Or she, her safety
mm-hmm.
zone.
Yeah.
But it's difficult to know if a person is actually somewhat going into a trance and just staying in
mm-hmm.
that trance.
Yeah.
Or because it's a repeat
mm-hmm.
pattern.
Yeah.
Or is it she actually needs that safety? It's
mm-hmm.
evolutionary.
Yeah, yeah.
It's hard to know.
Yeah. Yeah. And from a larger, stepping back, looking at it from a distance, the trance is seen as a necessary thing. Tara Brach tells us this tale of a young girl who's having too much emotional pain, and this fairy or this angel or some being came to her and says, "I will take your pain and I will hide it in various places in your body. And you'll feel a tightness in your belly and a clenching of your throat, which will be uncomfortable, but it will be less uncomfortable than the pain you're now feeling. I will also place within you the longing for health and wholeness that will speak to you. And when you're ready, when you're able, you will release these things." And so the trance or the contraction, the holding of trauma in the body is the wisdom of the organism to a certain extent, because overwhelm would occur. And so the trance is, in some sense, restorative. And we all have our places where we're at. So it's hard to say. The repetitive nature of it is of concern. I can hear that. But she is coming out to a different way of being regularly as well. So that can imply a certain kind of normalcy, and as long as that normalcy has some vitality to it, maybe it's okay. But if you see a fluctuation in that, where the vitality sinks, or there's surprising behaviors that are more distressful, then maybe more examination is needed. That's witching hours upon us, so Maybe if we could, maybe in our seats, chant the refuges together and close that in. And the refuges are on page 2, in Pali. And we'll do that to close our entire day in lieu of the closing chant for the lecture.
Tatyam pi sangam saranam.